Hello and welcome to another episode of the We're Not Experts History Podcast with myself, Sarah, and Mr. Basildon, aka James. Hello, James.
Hello, Sarah.
How are you? Good? Good day? Good day at the footy?
No, let's move on.
Okay, I won't even ask. I've had a great day, actually.
I'm good. Long summer has.
Yes. And now you're going to ruin it because you're going to talk to me about nonsense. No, I'm joking. What are you talking about
today? You're actually, no, I'm going to take you back to the 1920s, which would suit you because you dress like from the 1920s a lot of the time. So,
1940s, actually, but you were close. But anyway, go on.
Was there all that much? Anyway, so this is a little known subject I'm hoping going to enlighten you about.
Okay, hang on. I'm going to turn you down ever so slightly because I had my volume up far too loud and we don't want to deafen our listeners, I should say. Oh, God. Not cooperating. Right, okay, let's try that. Sorry, continue.
Right. So, what's the volume like? I'll cut this bit out.
Yeah, no, it's fine. It was I had it turned up because I'd been gaming and I forgot to turn it back down. My bad. Okay, we're good.
Okay, so we're going back to the 1920s. We've got a new marvel is transforming British homes. And that marvel is the wireless radio. And at the time, you tend to find a lot of the broadcasts on it were amateurs, very much like ourselves. It was an amateur hobbyist or experimental thing.
Yeah.
And then in 1922, along comes the British Broadcasting Company.
BBC. And
they quickly cultivated this image of an unwavering authority and being completely reliable. And its announcers became trusted friends to millions of households right up and down the UK.
Wow.
And this trust, it wasn't long before it was put to the test. So we're then going forward 4 years to 1926, and there was a dramatic broadcast over the airwaves which caused a quite widespread public alarm and pushed a lot of listeners into a genuine panic.
Right. And I've not heard of this.
No, that's what I'm hoping a lot of people haven't.
No.
I think most people will be aware of the War of the Worlds one in the States.
Yeah, only one I'm aware of, but I'm thinking, yeah, this is too early.
Yeah, so this one, this is 1926, 12 years before that.
Okay.
And yeah, the 1920s saw a huge transformation in how we, the public, received our information, our news, our entertainment. And that was thanks to the increase of use in wireless radio. It was, say, initially it was just this little niche interest, a lot of it for scientific experiments. Obviously, we're in Essex and up the road in Chelmsford, we have Marconi, who were very instrumental in the invention of radio and the radio broadcasts.
Yeah.
And those radios quickly exploded and become mainstream. So it was an essential fixture in British homes, like I suppose mobile phones were a few years ago. Everyone had to have one. I would say that British polyphone radio was probably bigger because it was
stony. Do you know what? I completely missed the point of that. Yes, yeah, sorry. I'm thinking now. That's why I said yeah. Because I'm thinking of now.
Everyone had to have one, yeah.
But yeah.
Radio offered this completely unprecedented immediacy, broadcasting voices and sounds directly into living rooms. So those distances. So you could be, if something could have happened in Newcastle and you're listening to it on the South Coast, you're listening to that news within, let's say, hours.
Mm. As opposed to having to wait for the
word of mouth on the newspapers,
or Telegram or whatever they would have had.
Yeah, and this This was a revolutionary technology which completely changed people's leisure time, as well as their expectations about how much news or how quickly they would get news. And amidst this new fascination was the BBC, and it was founded in October 1922, and it brought together several leading wireless manufacturers with the aim of controlling what was a chaotic growth of experimental broadcasts with the aim of providing a public service. And within the first few years under this, under the leadership of its first director general, a man called John Reith. And if you've ever heard of the Reith lectures, they're named after him. And the BBC very quickly distinguished itself. And he was a very staunch proponent of public service broadcasting. And he firmly believed that radio held a huge potential, not just for entertainment, but for education as well as enlightenment. And his whole ethos was instilled into the BBC, and that was a strong commitment to impartiality, accuracy, and moral upliftment, which quickly made it a very trusted voice across the country. I think a lot of people now would argue that that is no longer the case, but that's
No.
for other people to worry about.
Yeah.
The Beebs broadcasts, or Auntie, if you're old enough to remember when people called them Auntie, the BBC's broadcasts delivered in what became known as received pronunciation. So whenever I think of stereotypical BBC, I do think of the very posh, cut
Yeah.
glass accent, listening to BBC.
Well, even when you watch
If you
old
watch,
movies, they all speak like that. You know, you don't seem to
if
get,
you've seen
they
the
all
King's
sound the
Speech,
same.
if you've seen the King's Speech, the opening scenes are someone from the BBC delivering a broadcast, and that is how I think. Well, that's what this received pronunciation was about.
Yeah.
But that Queen's English lent an air of authority as well as calm, which really sat well with the listeners. And bear in mind, this is before television. Television was in its infancy. It was
Yeah.
invented in the 20s, or it was first demonstrated in the 20s.
But it
The
wasn't
radio was,
widely known.
yeah, but it wasn't. But so radio was the primary and the most immediate source for everyone's news and official announcements, as well
Yeah.
as a huge array of cultural programming. So it was in a very, very unique position, which fostered an extraordinary level of public trust as well. Especially then, chances are that it's the only radio station most people can pick up, if there
Yeah.
is any others. I don't know. Let's say it's hobbyists mostly. So,
Yeah, you might get a few pirate stations, but yeah, I know what you mean.
never know. I really don't know. So when a BBC announcer spoke, everyone who heard it just assumed that's the truth. That's it.
Yeah.
They straight down the line.
Yeah.
So this unwavering faith in the radio and the BBC was, it was a cornerstone of its early success, but it also it unknowingly set the stage for what happened in 1926, which it sort of demonstrated just how powerful this new connection with the public was. Now, we go on to 1926, and it causes a panic, this thing, because what they had do is on the 16th of January 1926, there's a fella called Reverend Ronald Knox, who was an early broadcaster. He was a Catholic priest, and the BBC were broadcasting what was just meant to be a documentary on 18th century literature, and he
Okay.
interrupted it.
Right.
So we interrupt this report, and it was all a play. It was basically, it was a satire on how the BBC broadcast news. So he interrupts this false documentary, this false talk, and he says that the Elizabeth Tower, which is known as Big Ben, Elizabeth Tower had been brought down by trench mortars in London, and the Savoy Hotel had been burnt to the ground,
Oh my
and a
God.
government minister had been lynched. Of course, people listen to the BBC completely believe this,
Yeah, because now you wouldn't. You'd be like, yeah, whatever.
Well, if I want to know something's true, the first thing I do is go to Twitter, because you guarantee something's happened. It's already on there. People are taking pictures
or
videos.
That's what I mean. We've got other sources now, haven't we? So it's like if you hear a celebrity's died, and you immediately you'll go check it on Google, and before you don't just assume, oh yeah, that's happened. Yeah. You'll go and double check.
Well, you do. Normally, if I hear a celebrity's died, I say who.
Well, in most cases, I do.
Yeah. A lot of them, and also a lot of the cases, I just assume they were dead anyway, and I was shocked, but they were still alive.
Yeah, that's normally happens to me. What?
I thought, I had no idea. But 1926, the Russian Revolution wasn't that old, so most people have that in mind.
Mm.
And we're getting to the point where the general strike's already been prepared. So it's panic stations, people are just panicking. But it didn't help that the content of this broadcast was so well crafted, apparently. It doesn't exist. I've had a look that you can no longer listen to it. It doesn't exist.
Oh, it's a shame.
It is such a shame. But they put it together so it simulated this sudden and violent national crisis. So it evolved a series of urgent escalating announcements, claiming to be live reports from various locations across the country.
So was it just meant to be kind of like an entertainment sort of play type thing?
Yeah, it was a satire on how the BBC works and how they would...
Right.
If it were true, how it would have operated.
So they didn't expect that it was going to cause this level of panic. That wasn't the intention.
No, you would have thought, if they thought that, they would never have done it.
No, that's what I wondered. Okay. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
I can't listen to it, so I don't know whether they come out beforehand and said, well, it's going to sound like an 18th century literature talk, but it's going to change. I don't know if they did that or not. I don't know how it was introduced.
Right.
But so within a few minutes in, I think the whole broadcast only lasted 12 minutes.
Okay, 12 minutes of absolute chaos.
Yeah. So the reports detailed fictional events, like widespread strikes, public disorder, government shutdowns, and even suggestions of foreign invasions, that always causes panics up and down. Even with the War of the Worlds in the 30s, that was an invasion.
Yeah.
But this broadcast incorporated realistic sound effects as well. So you had sirens and crowd noises and gunfire and crackle of distant explosions, which really enhanced the illusion it had created. And the voices of the announcers, who are usually calm, authoritative, shifted to this tone of increasing panic and desperation, which just convinced more people that what they were listening to was genuine. Especially, as I said, people listening to the BBC, they assume it's true.
Yeah.
And realism was so compelling that numerous listeners completely missed the fact that it was fictional. And they assumed that they were hearing genuine reports of national disaster. And this drama was aired without sufficient or clearly understood disclaimers. Or the disclaimers were simply missed by those tuning in late or momentarily distracted, which was, again, the case with the War of the Worlds in the 30s.
Yeah, because that was actually meant to be a joke, wasn't it? And
that one was just an updated radio play of the War of the Worlds.
Yeah.
That's a different story. But from what I understand is it was on a smaller radio station, which wasn't all that popular. But most people listened to another station at the time.
Mm.
And the show they listened to finished just after the hour. So they were then tuning in to Orson Welles, having completely missed the fact that it says, by the way, this is a play on War of the Worlds. And I also understand that the panic afterwards has been blown out of proportion and it wasn't that great.
Right.
Most of it was letters to the radio station complaining.
Right, okay.
But with this one...
It was actually real panic.
Yep. And the BBC were... Their switchboard was besieged. And it didn't help that then the following day, there was bad weather. So the delivery of next day's newspapers, especially in rural areas, they didn't get through. So people in these rural areas have heard this on the radio.
And they've not heard anything. And they can't Google it, can they?
No.
Can't text a mate and go, what's going on?
I have read on the BBC website, if you Google the riot that never was, And on the BBC Radio 4 website, it's still in the old BBC website format, which is great. I love it. But it does state that the BBC made several announcers that evening to say that the programme had been a burlesque. But most of those announcements went unheard. So people completely missed the fact that it was real. Yeah. So this is known that it was called at the time Broadcasting the Barricades. And the immediate fallout from the Reverend Ronald Knox's stark demonstration of just how the power radio held right across Britain.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, homes tuned into the BBC and were plunged into this state of alarm. Oh, my God, what is going on?
Yeah.
And the broadcasts, they obviously, it was, well, it says, what I've read online says it was a very realistic portrayal of national chaos. Well, how? I mean, no, I've never heard national chaos to tell you whether it sounded real or not. But I think, once again, if you're going to believe the BBC, you hear these noises, you're just going to assume it's real.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, obviously now, if we could hear it, we would now know it's a hoax. But whether how realistic it was, I don't know.
No, that's the thing, because we know going in that it's not real. But yeah, someone not knowing that
at the time, which is the BBC, it's truthful, it's authoritative, it must be real. But the reports from the time describe scenes of genuine panic. And the telephone exchanges, as I said, were inundated with frantic calls to the BBC. People were ringing newspaper offices and the emergency services. Listeners went out their way to try to get clarification or offered assistance or just to express their terror at the sudden breakdown of society. And accounts even emerged of individuals preparing for civil unrest. They were barricading themselves in houses or fleeing areas, absolutely terrified. And newspapers of the era quickly jumped on this incident with coverage ranging from alarmist headlines that sensationalised the public's distress, and as well as critically analysing the BBC's responsibility, as well as the ethical implications of this broadcast. And the newspapers went out of their way to condemn the BBC for its lapse in judgment, demanding the explanations for how a satirical play could cause widespread confusion. Nothing to do with the fact that the newspapers were terrified that the BBC were broadcasting news and potentially taking away people from reading their crappy newspapers. Not that you could do a crossword on the radio.
No.
So the BBC, the BBC faced quite a significant challenge to its credibility. Not that it worries about it now. But John Reith, the Director General, he went out initially at first, he defended this broadcast as he said it was an imaginative piece of satire, and the sheer scale of the public reaction forced a re-evaluation of this. Mm. So the incident triggered an intense public debate about the power and the influence of radio and this new early BBC's role in society. So official statements and internal inquiries followed, as they do, and these highlighted the urgent need for clearer distinctions between fictional programming and genuine news. Mm. I mean, now if you listen, obviously you tune into the Today programme on the BBC, at no point is it going to be fictionalised. But yeah, I mean, you had the Radio Times then. I'm sure it would have said in there that you've got, this is going to be a play. I don't know. But it was lessons for the early BBC.
And they are very early, aren't they? They're, what, 4 years in? So they're still 4 years babies. Into the
baby, yeah. Yeah, I suppose as well, I think it is a new medium. They're still learning. And I don't suppose at any point they thought, this is going to terrify people. Otherwise, they would have just knocked it on the head.
Hmm.
It's not going to happen. But while it was a brief incident, it left quite a large mark on the early world of broadcasting, as well as the development of the BBC. So this widespread public alarm, I'm going to have to go online and see what newspaper reports aren't find, even though I know they're going to be exaggerating, because I'd like to know how widespread it was.
Mm.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
bearing in mind what I said about the War of the Worlds one, we think the alarm for that was blown out of proportion.
But, I mean, I'm not familiar with the history of the BBC, but when they obviously would have done a broadcast, would it have been nationwide or would it have been certain areas?
I would assume it was nationwide.
Yeah,
I would assume
most of them. That's what I thought, because I know when we talked about a previous incident with the not War of the Worlds, it was other kind of alien related. But that was quite localised, wasn't it? Whereas that was because
ITV, so ITV was regional. You had different regional franchises covered.
Yes, that's what I meant. So it was only a local.
Would have been national, some of it was local. Yeah. And that one just attacked a local broadcasting tower.
Yes.
Whereas I'm assuming this one is national,
over.
The BBC. Yeah. I don't think the BBC was regional as much as then.
Especially not in those early days. Yeah, this is...
No, I think you just go to broadcast to as many people as you could.
Yeah.
I think the early days of the BBC's television was a little bit more London-based, especially as such as they are experimenting with it. Whereas radio by the 20s was, I think, what was that, late Victorian invention, early? I'm not sure. I'd have to look that one up. But I think one of the most significant outcomes of this incident was a tightening of broadcasting policies and their guidelines. The BEEB were becoming quite aware of the necessity for a clear, very clear, unambiguous distinction between factual news and reporting and its fictional, dramatic programming.
Mm-hmm.
I think after this, I think you do need to make a distinction, but two, well, you might be quite good at radio drama. I think we're going to have to look at this. It sounds like it probably would have been quite entertaining if you'd have known it wasn't real.
Yeah.
But this meant implementing much clearer announcements, especially before and after satirical or fictional content, just to make sure that listeners were never again confused about the nature of a broadcast.
Mm.
But it also shaped the BBC's evolving ethics around broadcasting and John Reith's vision of the public service broadcasting, in which he would emphasise education, information and entertainment.
Yeah.
I think in those orders, they wanted to educate, inform and entertain. And they wanted to reinforce that. And this event underlined how the critical importance of maintaining public trust as well. Now more than ever, I would say, because so many people want to scrap the TV license tax and are looking for loopholes. But then, I mean, I don't know how, I think you had to have a radio license when it started. I don't know. I should have looked this all up beforehand. I've not done very well with this. But
I didn't know about radio licenses. Obviously, I know about TV licenses,
You also had to have, there was a difference as well. At one point, you had a different license for black and white TV and a different one for colour.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so the commitment, this whole commitment to being impartial and being accurate, as well as making clear what sort of broadcast this was, it became a new cornerstone of the BBC's identity, influencing its foundational motto about being informing, entertaining, whatever it was. And this, the 1926 Radio Panic, quite catchy title, showed how great a reach the BBC covered and how much responsibility they had to its listeners.
Mm.
So the efforts that followed this were great, so just to avoid similar incidents. And I can't even imagine what that was like then. I didn't grow up then, funnily enough.
Before our time.
I think the reason it doesn't happen now is because of incidents like this. So they've learned their lesson.
Mm. It was one of those things that sort of had to happen in a way.
Yeah.
Like a lot of historical events that we talk about. you know, it's kind of like, well, if that didn't happen, this wouldn't have happened, or they wouldn't have learned this.
Lesson learned, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the only, yeah, and the nearest I can think of it, there was a program in the early 90s, I think it was called Ghost Watch. It was Michael Parkinson and Sarah Green, and it was meant to be filmed in a haunted house. And I can remember watching it for about 5 minutes, and it was so crap. It was so bad, I turned it off.
I don't remember it at all.
No, it was early 90s, so you would have been, what, eight?
Sorry, what was maybe. It? What was it?
Early 90s.
Radio or?
TV. It was on TV.
Oh, on TV, right. Yeah.
It was on the TV. And I can remember going into school either the following day or on the Monday and talking about it. And everyone else said, oh, it was really bad. But they also, apparently there was a lot of people who thought, oh, wow, they're actually in a haunted house. It was crap. It was absolute pony. I imagine this broadcast in 1926 had to be of a higher quality. But today, the lessons from that 1926 broadcasts are very, I'd say they're probably still quite relevant, particularly in our digital age of rapid information. So with the information we get now is going to be quicker than what they were getting then.
Yeah.
And it's, I suppose, once again, this is probably an early form of fake news.
Yeah.
Without the AI. Yeah. And it served as an early cautionary tale about the enduring power of media to shape our perception for the potential of misinformation to spread, even if it is unintentional, and the need for media literacy, this ability to critically analyze and evaluate information from different sources. And that's a direct echo of the challenges faced by the people who were listening in 1926. I'd love to know how many people had a radio in 1926.
I was going to say as well, because when I was talking about it being nationwide, and then I was in my head, I was thinking, even if it was nationwide, what percentage of the UK would have owned a radio at that point? Because the radio was still relatively new, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they were. The thing is, I think what people don't realise now is I think radios were relatively simple to make.
Right.
So you could probably make one. I know you could get kits, and they would be, so a lot of them would be battery powered with, like you had a thing called a crystal set where you had to take the crystals or the batteries or whatever they were to a garage to get them charged. But from what I understand, you could build the radio relatively simply.
Right. Okay.
Or you might find you could probably hire a radio, like you could hire TVs for a long time.
If there was a big event or something like that. Oh, what do you mean long term hire rather than buying? Have it on HP type of thing, I guess.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I've heard stories about people hiring televisions in the 50s so they could watch the coronation.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
Even in the 60s so they could watch the World Cup final in 66.
Yeah. Imagine that, having to hire a telly.
Yeah, madness.
It's just so normal now for everyone to have TV. I know not. I'm sure there are people that don't have TVs.
Yeah, very wise.
But yeah, it's just they're a common commodity now, aren't they? A bit like cars.
They're easy to pick up now, and they're almost certainly dirt cheap to put together.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's you don't even think about it now. No. TV in every room, whereas it would have been one in the street.
Yeah, and then everybody would go to that neighbour if they had a telly. Yeah, they were like famous.
It
will be like VR headsets now. I mean, they're becoming a lot more common, and eventually it will get to a point where everybody will have a VR headset, and that's rather just how you'll communicate. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the broadcasting the barricades, the right that never was. But it's a small historical event that just sort of reminds us that discerning fact from fiction, understanding context, as well as questioning your sources, are not new skills, but very sort of that they're saying you need to be confident about, just to make sure you're the information you're getting in is accurate. And even now, you go on the BBC and they have section on there about sort of that they'd have news in from like Gaza or something like that, and they'll have a little bit on there just about verification, so they'll just go and look at videos just to make sure what you're looking at is true. And that's that's the 1926 radio panic.
That was I wasn't aware of that, never even heard of it.
I don't know whether Orson Welles was familiar with that. I wouldn't have thought so. So 12 years, 1938, he did his War of the Worlds broadcast. If you go online, different places, you can listen to it. I have listened to it.
I've heard it before. Yeah.
Yes. To me, I would have realised that it wasn't real, because if aliens have invaded America, I don't think you're going to stop the broadcast so you can go over to a band. They did have music cutting in to the broadcast.
Oh, really?
The panic.
I don't want to say people were more gullible, because they were in a sense, but not because they were stupid or anything. It was more the fact that
it was different
times. Now you can manipulate a video with AI, so even if you see something happen on the screen, you question it, you know. Whereas give it 10 years ago, if you saw a video or something, you'd go, oh, that happened. You know, you wouldn't doubt it. Whereas now you go, is that AI? Did that happen? Has someone manipulated that? So, it's kind of, the times have changed, haven't they?
Yeah. I also, from what I can remember, I should have looked this one up before I'm going to start talking about it. But a few years after that War of the Worlds broadcast, there was another one in Quito in Ecuador. And again, there was a big panic. And when people realised it was a play, they raided, or they stormed into the radio station, and there was murders.
Oh, that's not very nice.
They were so outraged. No, they were so outraged that they'd been made fools of.
Oh, they were just trying to entertain.
As the Reverend Ronald Knox would say, here endeth the lesson.
Interesting. Well, that's something new. Do you know that what you said, though, slightly off, well, not completely off topic, but following on from what you said about how people actually went and kicked off at the radio station, it's a bit like, because, you know, I'm thinking, oh, how could people be like that? But it's a bit like when people get really invested in a movie or a series on the TV, and they actually take it out on the actor or the actress or portray a certain character. And I mean, I can't think of any examples offhand, but I've heard of where actors or actresses have played a particularly not very nice character in a well-known series, and they've been abused on the street because people can't differentiate that they are just acting. How could you do that? And it's like, I'm just acting. I didn't really do that.
Yeah, I seem to remember there was someone from EastEnders which automatically means they're not an actor, who was abused in the street. But I think that says more about the people who watch EastEnders.
Well, yeah, it's not the actor's fault. They're just doing a job.
You don't have actors in EastEnders. If you're an actor, you're not doing EastEnders, and it is the worst thing on television.
Have you watched it?
I have had the misfortune. I caught 30 seconds of it last year at some point
and nearly vomited.
It was shocking.
I'm not going to lie. I mean, I haven't watched it for years and I would not watch it now, but I used to watch all the soaps. I mean, when I was growing up, that was just part of our religion at home. You know, we had our soaps. We had Heartbeat on a Sunday night. I remember that. And Emmerdale, and then I think Saturday was Corrie and EastEnders. I think, I can't remember, but it was like a family event. You know, you all had to go sit in the living room.
I feel like storming into the broadcasting, into the BBC and ITV, and committing murders just from hearing about them.
Yeah, they're very. I mean, I found them entertaining at the time. Heartbeat was quite good actually, but looking back, I think, God, what a load of old misery. Like, why were we watching such negative, awful
No, oh. I don't know. TV for the hard of thinking. I still think it's aimed at the brain dead.
What are you trying to say?
You don't need to be alive.
You don't need to be alive to watch them. No.
I
think you just watch it. It just becomes part of your routine, doesn't it? But I guess now, you know, we've had the birth of YouTube and, you know, you can watch so much. I mean, I haven't watched actual TV for years, probably about a decade. I watch documentaries. Like, when I say proper TV, I mean like soaps. And I'm not trying to say soaps are proper TV. They're not. But you know what I mean? Normally when people say, oh, telly, I think of like soaps and things. Don't watch any of that. No, I watch documentaries and I just watch random things on YouTube and that's me sorted. And we've gone completely off track, but we're still talking about the BBC in a way.
It does take me back to John Reith. When in the early days of the BBC, he was quite open and honest because he told people that don't expect too much in the early days. The programmes will neither be very interesting nor very good.
No, well, they're still trying to fill their way out. This is a new thing, isn't it? You know?
Well, it's gone back to that now.
Yeah.
And maybe that should be our tagline.
Now they don't know what to do.
Yeah.
They're just putting out any old nonsense.
I think we've waffled enough.
All right, then. Well, thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. We hope that you potentially learnt something because, I mean, I myself didn't know about this. I don't know a lot. But yeah, you know, you may have learned something new. But just remember, we are absolutely 100% not experts. We're just two amateurs muddling through history.